Good afternoon. This is A Public Affair. I'm your host, John Quinlan. On today's show, we commemorate this month's 45th anniversary of the passage of the historic Voting Rights Act. Our guests joining us on the phone from Milwaukee is Renee Shavers, the Associate Director of the ACLU of Wisconsin, and also a very special guest, well, in both cases, but also joining us on the phone from down in Selma, Alabama, is Joanne Bland, favorite guest, who is the co-founder of the National Voting Rights Museum, currently a tour director for Journeys for the Soul Civil Rights Tours, and a veteran at the age of 11 of the Selma to Montgomery Voting Rights March. And just mentioned a little bit of the history here. Joanne Bland and I had the privilege of, I had the privilege of meeting her going back in August of 2006 when I broadcast my radio show Forward Forum live from the National Voting Rights Museum, where she was then the director. She's the co-founder of that museum, just an amazing grassroots museum where depictions of the Selma to Montgomery March are made in a very down-to-earth way. There's things like little slips of paper where people can record their favorite memories. There's plaster casts of the footprints of the folks who walked the 50 miles from Selma to Montgomery. For those of you who don't know this story, basically in March of 1965, the people of Selma and surrounding areas decided that it was time to call the state government on the fact that they didn't have voting rights, that voting rights were being discouraged, suppressed, denied among African American citizens. And so they embarked on this historic journey that had several fits and starts. The first few efforts were turned back as Alabama, the equivalent of the Alabama State Patrol, I think it's actually called the safety is in the word there, but anyway, folks on horseback brutally meeting with violence the nonviolent marchers who were heading out to Selma. And we're going to hear that story in detail, first-person account from our guest Joanne Bland in just a moment. But to make a long story short, it was those protests, later joined by Dr. King and some of his lieutenants, and then eventually joined by people from all over the country who heard about this gross injustice, people of all backgrounds and walks of life who came to Selma. And that set the stage for the passage in August of 1965 of the Voting Rights Act. So we're going to be exploring that history. Also, talking to Renee Shavers, as she's now known, and she's going to bring us some contemporary resonances with the current battle now going through the state legislature to involve in the voting process people who have had experiences in prison. Trying to make sure that they have those rights immediately reinstated if they've been removed. But this is something that has enormous civil rights implications as well, as we'll find out in just a moment. While we're waiting, I wanted just to share a contemporary story that's happening down in Selma, and Joanne Bland will have a chance to update us and, again, give us some more of a first-person picture of this. But there's an irony here in that on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, which again is this historic bridge that crosses the Alabama River, where these ugly events of Bloody Sunday occurred back when, and where ultimately, though, there was triumph as Dr. King and folks from the area and folks from all over eventually made that march to Montgomery. Well, you know, young people of the day wanted to do something to commemorate that and to also make another important bridge, which was between the white and the black youth of Selma, which unfortunately is still a fairly segregated place and a place where it's still taken a long time for any sort of equity to occur in terms of government. The first black mayor wasn't elected until the early part of, I believe it was 2001. We'll get a clarification on that again. But anyway, the young people decided to do a project called Project Dance, and hear from the Selma Times journalist Senator McCount of how they carry that off. It says, protesters from Project Dance stood and danced outside City Hall for about 15 minutes Friday afternoon. Demonstrators carried signs and danced in protest of Mayor George Evans' decision not to shut down the Edmund Pettus Bridge to allow for the dance. Organizers said they wanted to celebrate the 45th anniversary of the signing of the Voting Rights Act by performing a dance to Jai Ho, a song from the popular movie Slumdog Millionaire. It's important to us to dance on the bridge because of what the bridge stands for, said a member of Project Dance, who identified herself as Zusha. We're doing the dance to symbolize the freedom and the unity. So adults and children carried signs in the weeks before this asking for the right to dance on the bridge. You can see there's a bunch of people from Selma, Orville, and Dallas County. It shows support to show Selma and the United States our cause. It just feels great to see us all together and to dance, said Tanisha Hunter at the age of 11. Sophie East traveled from Atlanta to be part of it. She says, I came down because I really believe in what is happening here in Selma. It was great to be a part of the protest and the unity. It's just been really great to come together. And adults such as Kim Richardson also participated. From the history of Selma, it's been divided and it's still divided. She said, what I see here is black, white, young, old, disabled, and abled coming together for a common cause. So that leads us into a story that I hope in just a moment one of our guests will be able to help us further flesh out. And again, I believe we have in line both guests. Joanne Bland joins us from Selma, Alabama. Joanne, are you on the line?
Hi, John.
Hi. So glad you could join us. I sort of ended up telling part of the story that I hope you'll be able to help me finish off in a second. But before I do that, I just want to also introduce our other guests. And I must say that I think I'm very pleased to have two of my all-time favorite guests in one place. And it's a great privilege to be able to introduce you to each other. I also have Renee Shavers, who's the associate director of the ACLU of Wisconsin, on the line. And Renee has been involved in some contemporary resonances with the voting rights fight that Joanne was involved with back then in terms of folks who have served time in prison having the right to be re-enfranchised, be part of the process again. Hey, Renee, welcome.
Hi, John. Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm pleased to be here.
Yeah, well, thanks for being there. If I could start again with Joanne, and the story I was telling, this case of contemporary resonance. I mean, our history, of course, is relevant in here today because our history is still connected to stuff that happened way back when. But you were telling me on the phone the other night that the young people of Selma had come together with a proposal to have a dance and to demonstrate their unity and their common cause. But the city officials weren't too keen on that idea, were they?
Right. It's a mess, and the children are still protesting every evening.
Yeah.
They protest our paper and our newspaper. We only have one newspaper, the Selma Times Journal, and it's biased reporting. And then the mayor, one of the biggest issues was that he didn't give them a reason other than some people in Selma did not want them to march. And that wasn't acceptable. That wasn't good enough. If they couldn't dance on the bridge, at least give them the courtesy of giving them a reason why. There was absolutely no reason. At one point, he tried to lay it in the laps of the Department of Transportation, DOT. DOT said, nope, if you want to... we're not getting into that. You can close that bridge if you want to. And you make the decision. So he made the decision not to do it. But there are some other issues, John, that play into that.
Yeah.
Our elected president of the city council died recently. And the president pro tem is a man named Cecil Williamson, who is a known member of the... Southern League, and he still believes we're inferior, that blacks are inferior, and he doesn't mind saying it. And he's now the president of our city council in a predominantly African American city. And just recently, he attended the birthday party of Nathan Bedford Forrest. It's an annual celebration that I just found out happens. I wonder why nobody told me about it. I like parties. But it had these awful pictures of the caricature of a black child, you know, with the overemphasized features, white lips, eating watermelon, and right in front of the podium that he's speaking at. And these are pictures taken just recently. And the article in the newspaper was simply a feel-good opportunity for him to deny that he even saw the posters and that and to explain his side of the story, that he was celebrating his heritage and that Forrest protected Selma. Never mind all the bad things he did.
Oh, boy. Well, you know, as you were telling me the story, you mentioned that the young people had reached out to you asking for advice, and you pointed out something that you've emphasized every time that you've been on the show with me. It wasn't just older folk or the folk that we often look at as important as the role of Dr. King and his lieutenants were and everything. It was other folks who really laid the groundwork for all of this.
Without I explain it to the young people by saying that first and foremost, the majority of the marchers you see in the pictures from that time are young people, students. The majority were under 16, but nobody talks about that. It's like in the Army, the general gets all the credit when the foot soldiers actually win the war. And
you know,
I told when they asked my advice. Can
I
you
wanted
hear me?
To just jump in and say that they did the same thing here in Milwaukee when we had the housing marches. It was primarily young people who were marching.
Right.
And
Renee, why do you think that's so? And I'll give you my take on it. I'm just interviewing now, John. I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. Go for it.
No, that's fine. Well, I think there's a lot of reasons. First of all, they have more free time to do that type of thing.
Right.
They're also much more plugged in, I think, on a regular basis to what's going on in the community because, you know, they're not doing things like raising children and going to jobs and you know.
Right. And they're not afraid. They know that they're going to eat, have clothing, and have a roof over their head. They don't have very much to lose when it comes to that. And it was the same way in the 60s. Our parents had to work, and we were the ones with the free time.
Yeah.
And just as I used to, at that time, I was still riding roller coasters. I stopped that many years ago because now I'm afraid. And it's amazing how you go from that carefree stage to that, but the kids here don't see each other. This was a unique opportunity. The only activities they had together was when they put them together themselves, and it was flourishing, and we were crossing these eyes because they didn't have that crap that we were adults bring with them. We bring baggage to a relationship, and our children remember that, and they
right.
see that, and
really
before you know it, they're acting like us. That's the good and the bad.
You know, really interesting about that too is that I have so much respect for you and the work you did when you were younger, you know, in the Voting Rights Act and marching for voter registration, those types of things, the civil rights movement that you were so much a part of. But what sort of amazes me is today we've got the internet. You know, you can go online and organize a couple hundred people to show up anywhere in a very short period of time using Facebook or Twitter or a number of social networking tools. And back then you had telephones and flyers that you could put up. So the
right, and we had very few
to
telephones.
It was really sort of stunning and stands out. You know, with all the tools that we have today, I would like to see young people utilizing them to be more visible publicly in addition to online and the work that they're doing, you know, organizing individually.
Joanne and Renee, you both are leading us off in a good direction, but let me be fairly directive for about the next 4 or 5 minutes, and I'll let you go with it totally. But I want to get a few things in before we move too far into the show, just to make sure we do. Discuss this. And first, Joanne, if you could just maybe take the story forward a little bit. So what did happen on the bridge and what happened the day of?
Well,
a week ago today was actually the 45th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act.
Right. And this happened, you're right. It happened on the day, August 6th, when the Voting Rights Act was signed. Well, when they asked for advice, I simply told them if we had not engaged in civil disobedience in the 60s, we'd probably still be struggling for the right to vote, let alone to be together. But when they SCLC was allowed to, our local chapter was allowed to have the bridge closed for an hour and have a program honor some of the foot soldiers and simply commemorate the signing. I had walked off the bridge and I heard music. And I looked back and our babies were doing the dance. Oh, by the way, the dance was the dance at the end of Slumdog Millionaire.
Yeah.
The Jai Ho.
Yeah, great song for it. one other way to bring in all the interconnections and cross connections of this. This is something that was needed to be celebrated worldwide. So
exactly, and it was a beautiful sight to see. It just brought tears to my eyes. And another foot soldier. In fact, two other foot soldiers were standing with me. They're a little bit older than I am. I was tired of standing too, but. When they had to get off the bridge so they could sit down, because we were all standing, I walked down with them. When we looked back and saw that, I burst into tears, and the other two did too. We're standing; it was such a beautiful sight you couldn't help but feel it. That our babies were actually engaging in civil disobedience. It was wonderful, and my granddaughter was there.
You know, it just it's full of irony. And Renee is a proponent of civil rights and civil liberties. You'll appreciate this, but one of the police's comments it was kind of all over the map. The police chief says, even though the mayor told him he wasn't sanctioning it, that's something we'll sit down and discuss. What we look at is just public safety. Were there any criminal acts or anything of civil disobedience or that nature? And not even realizing the irony of what he's saying. I mean, this is what that event was about.
Exactly. I got arrested in the 60s for parading without a permit because I was walking with 20 other friends.
Yeah.
Two by two. Downtown.
And here they are presenting those same obstacles all again. We have a caller on the line, and our engineers have been very good about arranging this so we can take calls. Again, 608-256-2001 is that number. Caller, what is your comment or question?
Yes, thank you. I think the biggest story that's never really discussed is how Dr. King and the others were able to organize these young people into nonviolence. Somewhat easy to understand people rallying against a violent southern United States, very violent, but to train those young people to be so self-controlled, that's a story that I think needs to be told and discussed. We often hear that we have to be strong, but we can be strong in a nonviolent and peaceful way, and that seems to me to be a very central part of this. Could you comment, please?
We appreciate your question. Let me start with Joanne, and then Renee will give you a chance, too. Joanne?
Well, we really didn't have choices. You realize the foolishness of running up against all those weapons that they had. We didn't stand a chance. We didn't have any weapons. Almost every house in Selma, in the black community, had a shotgun because our fathers used them to help put meat on the table. But a shotgun shot, what, once, twice, double barrel twice, single barrel once, and you got 50 men in front of you with guns that shoot multiple times. And once we realized the futility of that, it was easy to be nonviolent. Now, there was a whole faction here in Selma that was not nonviolent, and I've heard stories from other counties and even other states where, but the people who deem to write out history don't want to write that part for some reason. They play upon the nonviolence, and not everybody was nonviolent, even the teenagers. In fact, we had a riot at Carter's Drugstore, and the young men fought back, and they tore up the store, but they were eventually arrested, but none were hurt so badly that it required hospitalization, but they fought back. And I understand some deputies, some of the sheriff's deputies, had to be hospitalized. But
as I've spoken to you over the years, I've gotten a sense of how complicated and nuanced this is. And it's easy for us to say how wonderful that value is when we didn't face the horrible violence and the oppressiveness and the disproportionality of the situation. And you also told me once a story. I'm sorry, I'm forgetting her name, but it was a woman who you pointed to as one of the true heroines who had had a confrontation with the sheriff.
Annie Cooper.
Yeah.
I just left from visiting Ms. Cooper this morning. Cooper is 100 years old now, you know. I asked her why did she hit that sheriff. She said, he hit me. And it was as simple as that. And
she hit him back, right?
Run it over.
Yeah.
Excuse me?
And she hit him back.
Yeah, she hit him back. She was standing at the courthouse, minding her own business, trying to register to vote, waiting for them to allow them to go into the courthouse when she said something to the lady beside her, and he grabbed Miss Cooper and swung her around and drew back his billy club to hit her. And she took it and whooped his behind, and she's my hero.
Yeah, well, you know, the underlying message, whether it was an incident like that where someone unexpectedly answered back after years of Jim Crow where the white supremacist establishment just expected people to roll over and go with it. That was part of the power of the moment as much as, you know, the nonviolent actions that were, you know, probably the majority of what was going on there. So it's a very complicated story. And in just a second,
if you think about it, how could people put you behind on a bus? We had to sit in the back of the bus and they couldn't see what we were doing.
Yeah.
And they had the confidence to do that. To put us in balconies in movie theaters, which was never a good thing, besides they were the best seats, but which was never a good thing. The audacity of a people to think that people had been so beat down that they would allow that, and we did for how many years?
Yeah. No, absolutely.
They didn't think
and Renee, please go ahead and comment.
There was a place for both the violence and the nonviolence.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And both existed. The nonviolence actually was boosted in some ways by the violence that happened. We had horrible riots here in Milwaukee. In fact, my parents told the story of how my mother had an infection and couldn't breastfeed me. And they were living right in the middle of the inner city of Milwaukee, and the riots started, and they could not, my father couldn't leave his home to get me formula in the middle of the night. Something as simple as needing to feed his child, he couldn't leave because the riots were so bad, and there was martial law in the city. The martial law was only in the African-American community. And so one of the reasons my parents joined in the housing movement was my father just frankly wanted to be able to leave his house in the middle of the night, and he recognized the fact that in white communities in Milwaukee you could still do that. And so there were some real tangible reasons that people joined those movements at the time.
Very much
things that were very personally affecting them. And, you know, the violence, you know, led to the nonviolent marches that were, across the 16th Street Viaduct for housing equality, and that eventually led to Val Phillips working with LBJ on the housing Equal Housing Act, the Fair Housing Act, nationally. So, I mean, those are, you know, all of those things sort of worked together in a way. Not to say that violence is always necessary.
Yeah.
And in some ways, the violence that happened was also instigated. We know that now by looking at old FBI records and stuff. That there was a very deliberate effort. My father also said around the same time, one day there just showed up on First and North, a whole truckload of weapons, of guns, and ammunition just showed up. And the back of the truck opened up, and there were you know, thousands of guns and a, like a huge semi, and people just started taking them. So there was also a very deliberate effort. Then, and that happened several times over the course of a couple of weeks, where the community, the African-American community, was deliberately armed by someone. You know, we don't know exactly who. But those things were happening. You know, there were two things going on there. There was, a nonviolent movement that was getting public national attention, and a violent movement that was both that rose out of the anger of the disparities in the way you could live your life as a human being, and then at the same time, this instigation that was going on by the government officials trying to force a violent movement to try and distract from the nonviolent movement. So, lots of interesting stuff.
All right,
talking about those two. How they work together.
Give me just a second to set up the show again for folks who may be joining in midstream. Again, this is A Public Affair. I'm your host, John Quinlan, and my guests on the line are Renee Shavers. She's the Associate Director of the ACLU of Wisconsin. And in just a few minutes, we're going to be shifting gears a bit to talk about some of the contemporary work she's done in the area of making sure that folks, once they've served their time, are re-enfranchised, re-brought into the process, and as we'll explain, and I know Joanne knows the resonances that are occurring down there in Alabama with all of this. You know, this is really vital in terms of civil rights and in terms of people having and communities having an adequate voice in their government. So we're going to be returning to that in just a minute. And then I'm also speaking with Joanne Bland. And as mentioned, she's the co-founder of the National Voting Rights Museum. As we're hearing, she was a veteran of the Selma to Montgomery March at the age of 11. And she currently directs some really wonderful tours. I encourage you all, if you're thinking of traveling to that part of the country, or make a special effort, as many folks from Madison have. She's part of an organization called Journeys for the Soul, and gives tours and explains all of the importance of this history. So what I'd like to do before we go on, just to save, because we ran out a little time earlier, and just to make sure we get this important story told, Joanne, when she's been on the show before, has given just a compelling narrative of what it was like to be part of that march. I'm going to go on and just play that clip. Mark, if it's the second clip on the background or the backup disc. I think this more or less sets itself up. We kind of come in midstream during the march itself. There have been a series of rallies, a lot of organizing going on locally. But on this occasion, which is known as Bloody Sunday, this is how it came down in Joanne's words as an eyewitness, as an 11-year-old.
On March 7th, we left Brown Chapel AME Church. And we came right down Broad Street and over this bridge and met that wall of policemen. When the line stopped, he said there would be no march between Selma and Montgomery. You have 3 minutes to go back to your church. In 1 minute and 15 seconds, they attacked. It was awful. I had never experienced violence. I was too far back in the line to hear what they were saying. But I was a warrior. I knew the procedure. I knew when that line stopped because we saw those policemen when we crested the bridge. When that line stopped, we would kneel and have prayer. And after prayer, we would go back to the church, regroup, and come back again. Suddenly, we heard gunshots and screams. We thought they were killing the people down front. Before we could turn to run, the front had turned, and with them came those policemen, swinging those billy clubs, hitting anybody, old, young, black, white, it didn't matter. They were just beating people. With them came that tear gas that turned out to be the gunshots we heard. Tear gas burns your eyes. It gets in your lungs. You can't breathe. You can't see. You panic. Oftentimes, you run back, right back to the same people you're running from. It was awful. Blood was everywhere on that bridge. They were running horses up in the crowd. The horses were afraid, and they would rear up. And when they came down, there was nowhere for you to go. In fact, the last thing I remember seeing on that bridge is this horse just running full speed. And this lady, as if in a daze, just stepped right in front of it. The sound of her head hitting that pavement was just too much. Cleophas Hobbs, he was 17 years old on the bridge. He said in his oral history, you could hear the bones breaking. It was truly terrifying. If you could outrun those men on foot, you couldn't outrun the ones on horses. I fainted. When I awakened, I was on this side of the bridge in the back of a car. And my sister Linda was in that car. And she was just crying. When I became fully awake, I realized it was not her tears falling on my face. It was her blood. Yet on that Tuesday, she held my hand as we followed Dr. King and Dr. Abernathy across that bridge again. Met that same wall of policemen. They said the same thing, only this side in the front went down. And we too knelt and had prayer. Dr. Abernathy led the prayer. After prayer, we went back to Brown Chapel. Dr. King held a mass meeting. At that mass meeting, he said he had applied for a court order that would give us the legal right to walk from Selma to Montgomery. On March 17th, a judge in Montgomery named Frank Johnson signed it. And on March 21st, we left Brown Chapel one more time, came over this very same bridge, and those same policemen who beat us up on the 7th had to protect us all the way from Selma to Montgomery. It took 5 days. People slept on the ground. Everything had to be brought to them. Started raining on the 2nd day. Nobody turned around. They kept going. And you know, it was 6 months, less than 6 months after our arrival in Montgomery, that the Voting Rights Act was signed. And it removed those obstacles that prevented us from voting.
Powerful story, and many of you, both here in Madison, especially at UW-Madison and Milwaukee, who may be listening in today, have heard this story, heard the power of what Joanne is able to deliver, especially in reaching out to young people. And we encourage you, talk about how this has made a difference in your life. Give us a call, 608-256-2001. Joanne, we'll come back to you in just a moment, but Renee, I just want to get your reaction in listening to that, and why is it important for young people, for all of us, to remember the history as Joanne's described it?
First of all, wow. Joanne, thank you so much for what you did. I'm like on the verge of tears right now. It was really moving. And I mean, what you did, what you accomplished by, you know, bringing that movement so publicly to the American consciousness and forcing an administration that was reluctant to do so into accepting the fact that the right to vote is a fundamental right for all of us was give us a true democracy. You know, there were two things that were accomplished during that period of time. One was the Voting Rights Act. Well, there were lots of things that were accomplished. But as far as voting, one was the Voting Rights Act, and the other was the right to vote for 18-year-olds. And those two things combined opened up the electorate to millions and millions of people for generations. Because of that work, we were able to elect people who represented their communities, both racially and ethnically and philosophically, across this nation. And the impact of what happened when the Voting Rights Act was signed and the work that was done to make that happen cannot be overstated. It really did change America for the better, and I just want to thank you for that. There's still work to be done, obviously, and obviously I worked quite hard on renewing the Voting Rights Act in 2006. I think it was 2006. Worked to renew the Voting Rights Act. Again, the provisions that expire, there are certain provisions of the Voting Rights Act that expire. There are more punishment provisions, and we have to continually, every few years, you know, reassess the Voting Rights Act and decide if the people who have, or the areas of the country where there were significant problems, like Alabama, if those problems have been resolved or not. And we were able to renew the Voting Rights Act, actually with the help, with very significant help here in Wisconsin, from Jim Sensenbrenner, who's been a champion of the Republican congressman, who's been a champion of the Voting Rights Act since the 70s, and helped to renew it both in the 80s and again in the last few years.
Yeah, so, I was really surprised to see his name as a primary sponsor of that bill. That's incredible.
Well, the right to vote is fundamental
yeah.
to being an American. period. I mean, it just, it is who we are. Our right to vote is who we are. And it crosses party lines. It should cross party lines. There should be no, philosophical barrier to voting, regardless of your political persuasion. And Sensenbrenner recognizes that. I may disagree with him on a million other issues, but I will continually give him praise for the work he did on the Voting Rights Act, because I worked with him individually on that, and he was a true champion for it in the Republican Party, not just in Wisconsin, but nationally. So, you know, the Voting Rights Act is something that doesn't have to do with, you know, it covers so many different things. There were so many things that were covered in that. There was one issue that was left out, and that's what we'll talk about, the felon enfranchisement issue.
We'll get to that in just a second. Apologies to interrupt, but we just want to make sure we get everything done we need to. We have a caller in just a second, but the other point I wanted to make briefly and bring Joanne into this, you know, of course, you're talking about this being something that it crosses party lines, but it also crosses divides of North and South. And Joanne's just brought that so powerfully home. I don't think I established this properly, but for more than a decade now, she's been traveling up to Wisconsin. I think the first major occasion was in Milwaukee on a panel called Milwaukee, the Soma of the North. And good friends like Joe McRae and Carol Lobus, who were youth that were fighting in those fair housing marches of the late 60s, were a part of that and since reunited with Joanne.
And
Dale, absolutely, and Val Phillips too. But let me just ask you. So you know, this is sort of a new stage of your activism in the here and now. But why was it important for you to spread that message up here? Why is it important for us to hear it and embrace it?
I always call it the Mason-Dixon mentality.
Uh-huh.
A lot of people think that it does not happen when we cross the Mason-Dixon line. Or that in the North, everybody's liberal and they accept everybody, and they have this freedom that we don't enjoy in the South, and they become complacent. But just as what happened here in Selma affected the nation, not just the South, We benefited a lot from it here in the South because we were visibly oppressed, but it also affected Wisconsin, and the problems we have today stem from us not knowing where we've been, because we continually make the same mistake. That's why we would even have an organization that Renee is head of. Otherwise, we would need those, right, Renee?
Right. Oh, our motto is eternal vigilance.
Uh-huh.
Exactly. Eternal vigilance. And that... And I also think it's my duty to do it. We have so many issues. Our education system sucks. And I can't think of a better word to say. And our children don't get this history and the true meaning of this history. It's glanced over. We talk about one or two people. And I call it a new hero, a new African-American hero every 10 years. And we learn about that person. Everybody can learn about that person. And then when the children realize the power they have to help affect change, just as we did in the 60s, we can have some real change because children see it clearly.
When they see themselves as capable of making the change, when they realize it was ordinary children, ordinary people like themselves that made it in the first place.
And that's the key word, ordinary. And they can affect change. They see it clearly. They know what needs to be done. They live it every day.
Go ahead, Renee.
And,
I'm sorry. I apologize. Go ahead, Renee.
I was at Marquette University doing a lecture on voting rights about a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago, and one of the young people stood up and said, you know, all this stuff that happened in the 60s, all these marches against the war, and she said, you know, I don't understand why we don't have those marches today. Why wasn't, why don't we have people marching against the war or for, you know, civil rights? And, you know, we know there's problems. Why aren't there people in the streets fighting for them? And I looked at her and I kind of laughed and I said, you know, the people who did that were college students. So my question is to you, why don't we have that?
Absolutely.
It really did start from the youth. And so I think it's, you know, there's sort of a disconnect in that you know, people understand the history, but they don't, they didn't quite get the fact that it was really very young people who were involved in it. And so they get the history lesson, but they see an older face in Dr. King and think, well, where's our leader today, you know? And they don't quite, and what they don't comprehend is that he was, what was he, 32 or 33 when he died?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, he was very young very when young. He died. He was still a very young man. All that work
today, but not
like 20
him.
To 30,
he's an old man to the two of them.
Yeah, yeah. We have a caller on the line. We want to make sure to get to that, and then Renee, we'll go into that other aspect of all of this in just a moment, in terms of folks who've been in prison and why it's important to reenfranchise, fully reinvolve them in the community. Caller, your comment or question?
This is Kirsten. I'm calling from Wanakee, and I just want to call and say that Ms. Bland is my hero. I was a group of students from Wisconsin. I can't even talk to you without crying, Ms. Bland. I was a group of students from Wisconsin in 2005 who volunteered at the museum in Selma for the 40th anniversary of Jubilee. And it absolutely changed my life. Your story has been told in many, many ways, and I had, 2 weeks ago, I was with a group of high school students. I'm a pastor now. And I was with a group of students talking about doing what matters. And I told your story, and they were absolutely spellbound. And after a long day of working on a mission trip, talking to them about doing the things that matter in their lives, and told the story about that you just told on the air, and you could have heard a pin drop in a room of 40 high school students. So thank you, thank you, thank you for changing my life and for continuing to tell your story and doing the amazing things that you are doing in this world.
Joanne?
Oh, sweetheart, thank you so much for what you're doing. And thank you for coming to Selma. You guys always say such great things, but you guys work so hard when you get here. And then you go back and do wonderful things. And that therefore, if you can improve that community, it's going to improve mine here in Alabama, and I thank you.
And Kristen, if we can do some organizing on the air here, if you have something to write with, and I'll give you this later, but put my number out there, which is 608-213-8409. I'm very interested in talking to other folks like yourself that have seen the power of Joanne's presentations. We want to get it out there further, though, because it sounds like you heard it in the context of being a student at the university, and we really want to get it into congregations and auditoriums and other places all over the place. So I hope you'll maybe join us in those efforts. All right. Well, thanks very much. I want to shift gears and make sure that we talk. I apologize that we're kind of about our last 8 minutes or so. But Renee, why don't you, if you could, reintroduce the subject of that you've been working on so hard and trying to get some change at the state legislature in terms of folks who have had the experience of being in prison. Why is that important, not only to those folks, but to all the rest of us?
Sure. We've introduced a bill. ACLU has been working hard to build the Restore the Vote Wisconsin Coalition. And the bill that we introduced in the legislature restored the right to vote to ex-offenders immediately upon release from prison. So current Wisconsin law is that if you have a felony conviction, this does not apply to a misdemeanor, but if you have a felony conviction, you are banned from voting while incarcerated, while on probation, parole, or extended supervision. And then your right to vote is restored immediately. After that, you just need to go register. So I want to first make sure that everybody understands that, so that if there are any people out there who have a conviction, one of the biggest problems that we have on the ground right now is that people don't understand that. That's a really confusing law. So you do have the right to vote after you are done, right now in Wisconsin, after you are done with incarceration, probation, parole, and extended supervision. Once you have finished that sentence completely, you can vote again in Wisconsin. So with elections coming up, I want to make sure that that's very clear to everybody out there. Your right to vote is not taken away for a misdemeanor conviction regardless of your probation or parole status. So now that we've got that clear, what we're trying to do is in 14 other states, and then in that they allow the right to vote immediately upon release from prison, this is a lot the right to vote, first of all, is sacred. We talked about that earlier today. And when you live, work, pay taxes, raise a family, are rebuilding your life and your community, to not be able to cast a ballot for example, for the school board member who makes critical decisions about your children's education, is completely contradictory to being an American citizen. They found that ex-offenders in the states, in the 14 states where they do allow them to cast a ballot immediately upon release, and also in the two states where they bring the ballot boxes into the voting booth and everyone, into the prisons and everyone votes, Maine and Vermont don't have any felon disfranchisement at all. What they found is that ex-offenders who vote re-offend at a rate of about half of those who do not vote.
Renee, if I could interject, there's something I want to get in. We are kind of down to the last few minutes here.
Oh, sure. Sorry.
No, that's all right. Molly Stentz, our news director here, or news facilitator, had asked about an interesting thing I hadn't thought about. You know, this is the time of reapportionment, resettling voting districts and everything. And in most places, prisoners are counted as living in the place where they happen to be in prison at the time. And that has this huge effect of skewing things both for that community, say it's Waupun, or the community that they come from in terms of getting proper representation. Does that sound like an issue that may also be worth working on?
It is an issue that's worth working on, and there are there's a proposal out there in Wisconsin, in the Wisconsin legislature, to resolve that, but I'm real iffy about the proposal.
Okay.
The proposal right now to resolve that is, I mean, you know, essentially what happens is you've got a prison in Waupun, Wisconsin, way up north, and they've got, maybe 3,000 people, and so in that prison, I'm just throwing a number out there, but there's maybe 3,000 people in that prison. The majority of them may be from other communities all around the state, and, you know, they'll be from Milwaukee or Racine or Green Bay, and because they're counted in the Waupun district, for the purposes of reproportioning, they can't vote, but they're counted. It's almost as if, in the slave plantation days, when slaves were counted for the purposes of redistricting, for congressional seats and local seats, and yet they didn't have the right to vote. So there's a real big problem with that. And Wisconsin currently counts them where they're being housed in the prison system, as opposed to where. The communities they were originally arrested in. Some states, it's done differently all over the country. I know Obama's proposed sort of a national standard.
Okay.
There's been a standard, well, we won't count them at all, that's been proposed in Wisconsin. I'm not real crazy about that either.
Yeah.
They do exist. They should, their communities should be represented. How that's going to work out, I'm not sure in this, now that the census is done. I know it's going to be a big deal in Wisconsin because we did have one of the highest counts in the country here because of the work of so many groups, nonprofit groups, to get education out there around, make sure you fill out your census. Wisconsin was one of the highest counted in the country. So I do know that it's going to be an issue. In the next year or so, we are definitely, ACLU is definitely going to be involved in that in some way. We will be working in the dialogue, be a part of the dialogue and a part of the conversation. We have some basic rules as to how we think it should be done, and that's, real simple.
And of course, down to our last minute, so I just want to make sure folks know how to get in touch with you if they'd like to be involved with this. And of course, there's a whole constellation of voting rights-related work. Making sure that voter repression isn't happening, making sure that everyone has that right. And I know you all are working in coalition. Is it ACLU-WI.org? Is that your website?
Yes, it is.
And the phone number, do you know offhand?
The phone number is 414-272-4032. And I'll give you my extension. It's extension 15.
All right, very good. And Joanne, I also just want to make sure folks knew about, again, these tours.
Work on voting rights in Wisconsin.
Absolutely. These tours we were talking about, Journeys for the Soul, I guess, is the organization.
And Journey, John, not a tour.
Journey. Okay, I know that's a trick. So just tell me what it is for sure then. What is the website?
It's Journey for the Soul.
Okay.
.com.
JourneyfortheSoul.com. And okay, and that'll have all the information on how to reach you. I really appreciate both of you joining us today. Mark, can you cue up that music, the single disc that I was telling you about? As we close out here, let's remember the spirit of those young people on that bridge, the Edmund Pettus Bridge.
Thank you.
Yeah, and coming together, black and white from many different backgrounds, many different places, to this music, Jaya Ho, that has this wonderful international aspect to it, too. Remember their courage, the courage of those that had the fortitude like Joanne to come together as young people back in 1965. Let's carry that spirit forward. Joanne Bland, Renee Shavers, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
आजा आजा जिंदे शामी आने के तले हैं आजा जरीवार नीले आजमाने के तले हैं